very much. It's a particular pleasure to introduce Professor Marilyn Lake this evening, though it's also fair to say that it's she needs very little introduction to this audience tonight. Marilyn is without doubt one of the most influential historians of our time. As both scholar and teacher, she's helped to recast our understanding of Australia and encouraged us to reimagine our past in ways that are critically different. I won't reprise her work in detail because I'm aware that you've had a summary before you and on the website, but it is fair to say that from her earliest research on the First World War and then soldier settlement after the war, she forced us to ask fundamental questions about the way we approached our craft. These were questions that went to the very heart of historical practice, the sources we used, the questions we asked of them, the stories we wove from them. Most importantly, she looked beyond the traditional historical actors to seek out the experience of what we then called the others, who were only just beginning at that point to emerge from the historical shadows. The failed farmers, the struggling wives, the children of soldier settlers. As a feminist historian and an historian of feminism, she's helped to reshape our understanding of Australian history. In her lecture tonight, she's returning to the topic of her second book, The Limits of Hope, Soldier Settlement in Victoria, 1915-38. I first asked her if she'd present this lecture as part of a commentary on an exhibition which we're showing at the moment at the Old Treasury Building on soldier settlement, and she very kindly agreed. And so tonight she returns to reflect on that work that was her doctoral thesis in a lecture that she's entitled Simply Because I Was an 18-Year-Old Hero. Will you welcome Marilyn, please?
Okay, thanks very much, Margie, for that very kind introduction. I would like to begin generally by thanking all of you for coming tonight, by thanking Margaret Anderson for this invitation to speak. We were, as Andrew suggested earlier, we were all thrilled to learn that one of Australia's best historians had decided to move back, to return to live and work in Melbourne as she took up the role of General Manager at the Old Treasury Building. And as most of you will know, and it's already been mentioned, the Old Treasury Building is currently hosting an exhibition on soldier settlement in Victoria after World War I, which was the subject indeed of my PhD thesis and subsequent book called The Limits of Hope, published by Oxford University Press. In fact, it was actually my third book, but that's all right. I thank you to the Royal Historical Society of Victoria for their invitation to present this lecture here on the occasion of the AGM, and I have to confess it's the first time I've been here, so I'm really delighted to have found my way here. It gives me great pleasure to take up then this combined invitation, not least because it provided me with a reason to return to this research on soldier settlement after World War I that I undertook so long ago for my PhD thesis in history at Monash University. That began in the late 1970s and finished in the mid-1980s, fitted in between the birth of two children and a four-year tutorship at Monash along the way. And I was assisted, I should say, in this PhD project by a sequence of distinguished supervisors at Monash. First, Duncan Waterson, then Agle Shaw, then Graham Davison. I was also fortunate to see the thesis published by Oxford University Press as the book, The Limits of Hope, Soldier Settlement in Victoria, 1915-38, and was indeed doubly fortunate to have it shortlisted that year for the Age Book of the Year Award in 1987. But there my luck ended, because that year Robert Hughes's The Fatal Shore was also on the shortlist, and so I was pipped at the post. So this lecture takes me back to that rewarding, if also in many ways disturbing, project about the costs and casualties of war. And it's also taken me back to see the exhibition at the Old Treasury Building. I assisted with some of its preparation earlier with the curator, Kate Luciano, but I think I was overseas when it opened. And so I was prompted to go back and see it a few days ago. And I must say that I found the poverty and misery and bleakness and hardship there on display quite confronting, and I'll come back to that. Because it is a graphic display. There are vivid photographs, black and white photographs, of the people and the landscapes. But the exhibition also suggests, by contrast, the paradoxical richness of the literary sources generated by that scheme. The exhibition itself displays a sample of the thousands of letters that soldier settlers and their wives were incited or compelled or provoked to write to the authorities. In their anger and frustration and despair, the settlers and their wives put pen to paper, week in, week out, to protest against the conditions in which they found themselves, the endless demands for payment, and the demeaning experiences forced on them and their families by an ill-conceived scheme that resulted in two royal commissions, a state one and a federal one, and the writing off of millions of pounds in accumulated debts. This collection of letters, which is now housed at the Public Records Office of Victoria, and I heard the other day some of which are digitised. Is that right? Has anyone heard that? I was quite astonished. This collection of letters is surely unparalleled as a source for historians. And of course, it was one of the great joys and rewards of working on this as a PhD candidate, of coming across this very rich collection. It's an unparalleled source for working class history, for social history, for women's history, for political history, for agricultural history, for environmental history, and most importantly, which is how I worked with it, the intertwining of all these different kinds of history, the intertwining of political history and women's history and agricultural history. These letters are a fantastic source. We have in these letters the stories, and I should say, in addition to the letters, there are all the inspectors' reports. And one of the things about that scheme, which was quite striking, was that the settlers were put under close surveillance by the state. And so they regularly sent inspectors out, and those inspectors' reports, of course, are also really valuable documents for historians. And then at a higher level, they sent area supervisors out. So there's a wealth of inspectors and supervisors' reports as well. And so we have in those records the stories of thousands of people's lives told in their own words. And this is quite unusual. The stories told not in later words of recollection, as in oral history, but in their own contemporary language. We thus become attuned to their
has it come off? Do you want to hook me up again? Or is it off? I don't know.
It won't be that, it'll be this one.
I could just project. I'll go on, shall I? Understandings of the world.
discursive resources, you know, what they have to say, we come across their shared values and expectations as returned soldiers and also as would-be farmers and also as husbands, wives, partners, parents. And indeed, these very rich literary sources could yield much from closer textual analysis.
Actually, you better come. I can't see what I'm doing.
Okay. So there are these beautifully rich literary sources, as I call them. And in these sources, the settlers and their wives literally speak for themselves, and which is, you know, what makes them such a valuable and unusual resource. Particularly, we're looking here at, you know, over 10,000 settlers. I thought at the time, indeed, when I did my research, that a collection of these often eloquent testimonies should have been published, you know, as a collection of texts. But at that time, there was little interest, this is the 1980s, but maybe 20 years later, in the context of the Anzac boom, they might have and should have found a publisher. And I'm going to quote, go back to some of these testimonies in this talk tonight. The protests of these men and women were heartfelt, and what you see sort of acted out, enacted in the files, which were kept across a number of years, is the reaction of settlers and their wives to the conditions in which they found themselves. And in response to that, they often mobilised politically. Sometimes they protested individually. So Harold Nichols, for example, a professional man before the war, an electrical engineer by training, expressed his strong sense of being cheated and denied the assistance he thought he had been promised. In 1925, he wrote to the Closer Settlement Board, quote, "All I'm asking for is promises to be fulfilled." His debts, like the debts of many others, nevertheless continued to mount. His hard work was to no avail. It was impossible to make a success of his block. When he left the Mallee in 1933, he was sent a notice to pay nearly £4,000 back to the government. In his outrage, he turned to the RSL, writing to Anzac House, quote, "After wasting 10 years of the best part of my life on a proposition which the Commission admits is hopeless from a wheat-growing point of view, I do not want to be forced out with a debt chasing me. Simply because I was an 18-year-old hero in the war and upon my return had sufficient faith in human nature to believe the lies told of the Mallee and the inducement offered me as a Dookie College student to take up land in the Mallee." The burden of debt followed thousands off the land. And the soldier settlement files, again, are interesting in that they contain extensive police reports as police across the state tracked failed settlers from town to town, from suburb to suburb, reporting on their condition, on their whereabouts, trying to ascertain their capacity to pay. So you also get a sense of what their lives were like after they left the land, you know, usually as labourers going from short-term job to short-term job. Another settler, Walter Best, declared that the action of the board in sending him an account for £393, 6 shillings and eightpence after he'd left his block, he said was simply scandalous. And it's interesting, by the way, that he put the word scandalous in quote marks. You can sort of like any suggestions later. It's interesting that he's quoting a word here. It was simply scandalous, he said. And he told his own story, as many did. He said, I was placed on a block of land by the closest settlement board that through the poverty of the soil would grow practically nothing. After spending every penny I possessed, including the gratuity and deferred pay, and battling for 2 years to get a living for my wife and kiddies and myself, I received orders to resign myself, otherwise the order of the boot. And now to send to my notice to pay £393, 6 shillings and 8 pence, a thing that is simply scandalous, which if brought under the notice of the public would make them cry aloud their indignation at such an infamous swindle, to entice a man after fighting for his country onto a block of land that was worthless, wait till he was penniless and then drive him off. Where is the fair deal, he asked, the soldiers were going to get when they came home? And you can see in all of these letters this implicit sense or explicit sense of entitlement, the fair deal, the promise. In Walter Best's case, and I should say I changed the names of these settlers in the book because there was such, you know, private information about them. So these are the names I gave them. So in his case, in Walter Best's case, and this was quite common, economic trouble was followed by and often exacerbated by domestic trouble. The two things went hand in hand. In this case, the family separated and two of Best's children were made wards of the state, which surely wasn't one of the outcomes anticipated by this scheme. So by 1917 and 1918, soldiers were being promised so much, in part to induce more men to voluntarily enlist. Because one result of the defeat of two conscription referenda in 1916 and 1917 was the increased pressure on potential recruits, the need to plead with men to enlist voluntarily by promising them all sorts of rewards on their return home. Thus, soldier settlers had a strong sense of entitlement that fueled their political campaigns, which were waged through the RSL, the Country Party, and local members of Parliament. And they were confident that the public would support them, which the public mostly did. When one nationalist MP, D.S. Oman, allegedly described soldier settlers as sponges, he lost his seat at the next election. Now, when I revisited the story of soldier settlement as depicted in the exhibition at the Old Treasury Building, I found that in some ways it presented a story to me with which I was quite familiar. I mean, in some cases, you know, some examples and quotations and the letters are the same ones I used. But I was nevertheless, I was appalled afresh at the harsh consequences of this reckless agrarian experiment, which is how I now see it, this reckless agrarian experiment, which was visited on so many hapless families. Now, Australia was, of course, a land of experiments. This was its proud sense of itself, the minimum wage, compulsory arbitration, women's suffrage, old age and invalid pensions, etc., etc. But here was perhaps the most radical experiment of all, whose effects ruined thousands of lives. All Australian states provided for soldier settlement. It was a federal scheme. But Victoria, a federal scheme carried out in conjunction, obviously, with the states and their lands departments. But Victoria placed more discharged service people or their dependent relatives, some of whom were also eligible, on the land. Victoria placed more on the land, both proportionately and in absolute terms, than any other state. Altogether, around 10,500 settlers participated in the Victorian scheme. And I think I recall that 1/6 of all properties in Victoria changed hands at that stage. And of course, the sudden demand for land sent prices soaring. It was a good time to sell land, but that only exacerbated the debts taken on by the settlers, the money they had to pay back. So soldier settlement was both a cynical political exercise at many levels, aimed in part at removing restless, wounded, often violent return men from city streets, getting them, pushing them out of sight, out of mind, into the country. But at the same time, it was also a profoundly ideological enterprise, animated by a dogmatic faith in the redemptive power of life on the land and in the yeoman ideal of self-sufficiency and independence. And again, the imperative still to fill Australia's vast empty spaces. Australia's rural acres would become, in the words of an Age editorial in 1915, quote, the breeding grounds of health and wealth. In a quite profound way, however, and again this became, you know, sort of starkly evident to me when I saw the exhibition, in a quite profound way, the soldier settlement scheme was out of its time. It was an anachronistic enterprise, inappropriate for so many reasons to the 20th century. And I was struck anew by the contradictions between the agrarian myth and the imperatives of modernity, between the aspiration to independence and the crushing dependencies that followed, that always, these contradictions that always threatened to undermine the viability of the scheme and to break the spirit of its unlucky subjects. And indeed, these contradictions did undermine its viability. It was a failed scheme. There'd been suggestions during the war for alternative kinds of post-war reconstruction. For example, that the disruption of international trade caused by the war should be turned to account and become the occasion and the stimulus to the creation of new industries, cooperative companies, new manufacturing enterprises that might be located in regional ports and larger towns that would provide skilled employment for returned soldiers. And many of these sort of ingenious proposals were sent in to the repatriation department and in the files of the repat department. You know, you can look through these proposals for what might have been. But such ideas stood little chance in a society shaped by the logic of settler colonialism and the obsession with land settlement within that. Soldier settlement followed in the tradition of earlier schemes of free selection and closer settlement, and it would be joined post-war also by imperial settlement, following the visit by Sir Ryder Haggard to the Australian, I was going to say colonies, in 1916. And indeed, he came out from the Royal Colonial Institute. The soldier settlement scheme was initiated in 1917, just 2 years after a Victorian Royal Commission looking into the previous civilian closer settlement scheme. That Royal Commission, in 1915, and this is almost unbelievable, really, it inquired into the failure of the previous scheme of closer settlement, concluded it had been a failure, largely because settlers, they said, didn't have sufficient capital. Farming had become a capitalist business, and indeed it had long been a capitalist business in Australia. And the report concluded, quote, the evidence shows conclusively that a considerable amount of capital is necessary to ensure success, and the acceptance of men with little capital is an injury to them and a loss to the state. So this was the clear conclusion, but 2 years later, this much bigger scheme of soldier settlement proceeds with men who not only lack capital but have often been wounded in the war. So in face of all the evidence, an expanded soldier settlement scheme proceeded. And settlers began to establish their farms, and they faced immediately the volatility of world markets. That's such a contemporary phrase. The volatility of world markets is what they were up against. These yeoman settlers mostly did not and could not even feed themselves. But, that is, because they couldn't and didn't grow gardens, the whole sort of image of these yeoman settlers, you know, having chooks and gardens and apple orchards, you know, it was a fantasy. And the files, again, give us lots of evidence about what they ate and their grocery lists. As I said, they're very rich sources. So they depended on state advances from the beginning to buy food and food and every, you know, implements and everything else, stock. And therefore, they were subject, as I said before, to regular inspection. To regular inspection of and comment on their grocery lists by the district inspectors. Sometimes the settlers offered up the grocery lists, sometimes the grocers who, you know, kept a tab would do that. The grocery lists in the files provide detailed information on settlers' diets. And this too is a, you know, it's another sort of history, but I mean there are so many different kinds of history one could do from these sources. And in these lists, it's clear that factory-produced food, now this is an industrial age, factory-produced food, including flour, corn flour, sugar, rice, biscuits, canned meat, fish and fruit, jellies, butter, cordials and jam, and commercial medical preparations such as Aspro's, Hypol, Dr. Williams and Beecham's pills were common. This was the standard fare that they purchased with state advances from the local grocer. The state, needless to say, insisted on frugality. And the scrutiny of one settler's grocery account prompted the inspector to comment in writing, his groceries included tobacco, saveloys, honey, sauce, pickles, which surely cannot be classed as necessary edible stores. And it's an interesting phrase, and it reminds us that weasel words were invented long ago, necessary edible stores. He doesn't just write food. And you can see here, you know, the demeaning intimacy with which these people's daily lives were interrogated. Settlers were expected to utilise family labour. That was part of the yeoman model. They were to use family labour rather than become employers of wage labour. The whole scheme, you know, was meant to free people from wage relations. So they were expected to conscript their wives and children to work long hours, even as women at the same time in the 1920s were exhorted to attend to their own ever more arduous work in the home and with children. And children themselves were required by law to be in the schoolroom. At a time when education was free, compulsory and secular, do you remember those times? Soldier settlers' children missed school for days on end or fell asleep at their desks or arrived late, or they didn't have the appropriate shoes or clothes to wear to a public school. And it's quite interesting, again, to think about the sort of humiliation visited on children who don't have, you know, the shoes or whatever to wear and the notion of a public school. Some children were kept home from school by permit, but widespread urban criticism of child labour at the same time challenge settlers' need to employ their children. So again, this is one of the contradictions. Settlers are expected to employ their children, but the state in other departments condemns child labour. You know, this was, one of the boasts of Australia, that it had outlawed child labour. The labour movement had long opposed the use of child labour, and the women's section of the Victorian Labour Party specifically denounced the employment of children in the dairying industry as being detrimental to their physical and mental development. Faced with growing public criticism, settlers became defensive. quote, "No mother likes her little girls to have to go to the cow yard," wrote one mother of three daughters to the editor of the journal The Countryman. "But what could parents do," she said, "when the price of butter was less than half the cost of production?" And of course, this too is now a lively issue. Referring to objections raised by the Victorian Housewives Association that, quote, "poverty does not excuse the employment of children in the yards," Jeannie McCarro, the president of the women's section of the Victorian Farmers Union, retorted, quote, "I think that anyone who knows what poverty really is would say otherwise." Women who carried the awesome responsibility of keeping children alive and well and well-fed and educated and were bombarded with increasing volumes of advice on how to do these things in the 1920s, including from the Better Farming Train that went around Victorian districts. These women were also expected to work outside, milking cows, fattening pigs, keeping chooks, and assisting with the harvest. In many cases, women invoked a discourse on slavery. "I'm not a slave," which is not surprising. And again, as I said, it's interesting what ideas the settlers and their wives had available to them to protest against these conditions. And they protested in a language of slavery against the burden of their overwork and their sense of oppression. And indeed, the sense that they couldn't escape this. With new and growing families to support, settlers also had to contend not just with a sense of failure as breadwinners, and wives often taunted the men with this failure, you're not even a breadwinner, you can't be a breadwinner, but also they had to contend with the ascendancy in the 1920s of modern medicine and the new authority of doctors. With childbirth and operations, and there seem to be always operations, now taking place in hospitals, often located in distant towns or cities. And illnesses, which again, the files, if you're doing medical history, the files are a fantastic source for the frequency of common illnesses such as diphtheria and whooping cough and measles. These illnesses were rampant and dangerous. There was much evidence in the files of doctors ordering settlers to keep their wives away from farm work in the interests of their health. And there's a sort of alliance between doctors and wives against their husbands, invoking the authority of doctors, "I'm not allowed to go into the cow shed." Doctors' orders then were often invoked as a new source of power against husbands and against the closer settlement board. But women's illness frequently meant that the men had to look after their children, and they were thus themselves prevented from working on the farm. L.J. Hurley told the inspector, quote, "he was prevented from working by his wife's illness." Alfred Monk told the inspector that he was unable to develop the block as, quote, "I have a sick wife to look after. I can only get afternoons in with the team." When James Simmons's wife went into hospital to have her fifth child, quote, "things did not go right with her. And instead of having to be away about 3 weeks," he wrote, "she has been away 8 weeks. And I've had to look after the other children and cook and wash and mend for them. And in consequence, it has put me back with my work." And it's really interesting, the interplay of these dynamics in family life. And of course, remember that these settlers, sent way out into the Mallee and Gippsland and the Western District, rarely had family, had extended family near them. They were on their own. 6 months later, Simmons told the board that his wife was again in hospital, having had three more operations. There's some fantastic medical histories, by the way, that talk about how in the 1920s became the heroic age of medicine in some ways, and the doctors were always wanting to open people up and look inside. It's quite fascinating, and you can see a lot of that at work, seemingly. These families are always having operations. The medical bills added up, and there are medical bills, obviously. The medical bills added up, in this case, to £300. And in addition, he was forced to purchase a milking machine. Now, this is also interesting in terms of the relationship between women's labour in the sheds and the purchase of milking machines. Between 1914 and 1939, the number of milking machines in Victoria increased from one in every 10 farms to one in every four. There was also evidence in the files of the domestic violence perpetrated by men, inured to violence during the war, and now angered by daily frustrations and humiliations. Domestic tensions were often unendurable and led to frequent separations. Ethel Lester, for example, on a dairying block at Mia Mia, south of Bendigo, and now part of the Heathcote Wine District, reported, she wrote this, she said, "I helped in all kinds of manual work, milking cows, 26 at one stage, for just the two of us to manage, rabbiting to get a few shillings to get clothes for self and children, bed linen or necessities for the house apart from food. One day, I helped to hold fencing wire to thread through posts. Unfortunately, I got a kink in the wire, and before I knew where I was, my husband threw me down by catching hold of my throat with his muddy hands. A gentleman called by, and the first thing, 'Oh, get a cup of tea.' I wonder, did he think of his cruel marks which were left when I gave out the cups of tea?" And there are several, you know, letters like that. She too, Mrs. Lester, left with her children in 1930 and sued for divorce. The case of C.M. Norris from Merino illustrates the tensions posed by domestic life and the settler's consequent dilemma. Allocated, quote, a splendid block of land of 139 acres in the Western District, he focused at first on dairying and fattening pigs, but his wife's ill health led to his decision to sell his own cows and go in for sheep. And there was, you know, this equation, cows, you need women, you need wives. So she was sick, so he sold the cows, went in for sheep. Some months later, the area supervisor reported that he said he'd sold all his animals and gone shearing, entering the very wage relationship from which Soldier Settlement had promised to free them. The inspector wrote, quote, "Owing to the bad health of his wife, who broke down on the place and had to be brought to Hamilton to be kept under medical observation, Norris had to have a clearing sale as he could not possibly, on his own, attend to the cows and pigs. Norris had given up. He applied to sell his land because the doctor, quote, had ordered him to keep his wife away from farm work." And you have that theme reiterated. Soldier Settlement, well, I mean, it was a large scheme, as I said, in Victoria, that 10,500 settlers were on the land with their families. It was an inclusive project. You know, everybody could participate in it. The exhibition at the Old Treasury Building points out that some women, as nurses, were allocated land under the Soldier Settlement scheme, as were a number of Aboriginal men who had managed, as, quote, half-castes, to enlist in the AIF. I wrote an account of one of these nurse settlers called Annie Smith, this is her real name, née Westcott, in a chapter in the Victorian commemorative volume called Double Time, Women in Victoria, 150 Years, which was edited by Farley Kelly and myself in 1985. And it also includes an excellent chapter by Judy Smart called Eva Hughes, Militant Conservative. It's a great collection, by the way. It's 50 biographies of Victorian women. And when I went back to that, you know, I was really pleased at this, all of this little work and research that was there. When I was doing this work to write this little mini biography of Annie Smith for the collection Double Time, I found out that she, I was working at the University of Melbourne about that time, and I found out from Geoffrey Blaney that she was related to him. I think she was his auntie or something. And I was, you know, quite astonished about this, that Victoria, of course, is, after all, a small world, even as it has been shaped by many larger ones, including market capitalism, imperialism, and the emancipation of women. My account of former army nurse turned soldier settler Annie Smith of Thorpedale in Gippsland told the story of her serving in Egypt. There's a nice photograph of her in her nurse's uniform in Egypt. And the chapter began on a sprightly note, and I'll just introduce her to you. Annie Maynard Smith was 45 years old when she left her work at the Caulfield Military Hospital to travel alone to Gippsland in the summer of 1920 to take up a soldier settlement block. Her age and her sex made her an unusual soldier settler. Her subsequent experiences of heavy labour, poverty, frustration, and final financial ruin were, however, all too common. Annie Smith's life on the land was marked by courage, perseverance, and hard work, but she, like thousands of other soldier settlers, found that sterling personal qualities alone did not ensure material success. It's interesting that they all had to get qualifying certificates to get on the land, and they often had to get references from people. And it's interesting to read the references as well. I mean, it's another sort of history, and the references invariably, you know, testify to their good character, that this would be the secret to success. So when I went back to look at this chapter the other day, I'd forgotten that Nurse Smith, as she was called locally, Nurse Smith, had been ejected from her block literally, quote, because she was a woman. When the inspectors looked over the dairy farm in the early 1920s, they found that it was in good condition, was well maintained, good water, and the cows were in good health. But there was a problem. Quote, if a man had this place, said the area supervisors, if a man had this place who was capable of doing this work, it would be good policy for the board to allow him to proceed. But, of course, there was no man on the place. They pointed out that Nurse Smith had to pay for labour to plough her land for cultivation, which added to her costs, but quite ignoring the fact that many male soldier settlers also employed casual labour, boy immigrants from England, for example, even though they knew it was frowned on. But Nurse Smith's lack of family support was clear for all to see. She was a single, separated woman. She'd left her husband in Melbourne. And she, again, recounted her own story in her own defence. My record, she wrote, in comparison with at least half a dozen soldiers who have left their blocks in the vicinity, was, I should say, favourable. As for one thing alone, none of my stock has died. And I have not disposed of any of the board's property without permission. I am in this position that if I were to go off the place of my own accord, I would be penniless, having put all I possessed into the improvement of the place. And naturally, going off like that does not appeal. I do not wish to leave as a beggar. She nevertheless did so 3 months later. Nurse Smith had survived 6 years. She was more fortunate than most, however, in that she had a professional skill. She was a trained nurse, and she could return to that work once she left the land. The exhibition at the Old Treasury Building, as I suggested before, also highlights the fact that some Aboriginal men, on returning from war service, were also allocated soldier settler blocks. Aboriginal men, if deemed half-caste, were permitted to enlist in the AIF. As Richard Broome, the leading historian of Aboriginal Victoria, has noted, quote, AIF soldiers came from Lake Tyers, Corranderk, Lake Condar, Framlingham and other parts of Victoria. Five of Hannah and James Lovett's boys, Alfred, Leonard, Edward, Frederick and Herbert, all from Lake Condar, enlisted. He estimated that that altogether 42 Aboriginal men of mixed descent enlisted from Victoria, one in three of those eligible, the same proportion to enlist as from the general population, which is interesting. Evidence, perhaps, of the extent of assimilation. The Old Treasury Building exhibition features the stories of two Aboriginal soldier settlers, including that of Private Percy Pepper of Lake Tyres. Some visitors have expressed surprise that Aboriginal men were not discriminated against by the state, because that's what they expected would happen. But the inclusion of Aboriginal returned servicemen in the soldier settlement scheme, I would suggest, expressed precisely the logic of settler colonialism. the replacement of Indigenous collective rights to traditional country by the allocation of individual allotments to be worked by individual farmers, as occurred in the United States, for example, with the Dawes Act of 1887. Advancement in civilizational terms meant assimilation. Progress was measured in the distance, progress as in progressivism, was measured in the distance travelled away from cultures deemed primitive. Australian progressives envisaged progress in these terms. Just a year before the American Dawes Act in 1887, Victorian Chief Secretary Alfred Deakin presided over the introduction of the Aborigines Protection Act that marked the beginning of, quote, the assimilation era in Australian policy. The goal was to absorb the mixed descent Aboriginal population into the white community. They would, this is quoting Deakin, merge the half castes and quarter castes into the general population, he told Parliament. Aborigines of mixed descent, once living among the general population, quote from Deakin, might be educated to earn their own living and thus become, he said, useful members of society, indeed useful members of the military. As we know, however, the effects of the Act were to break up families and communities, causing deep personal distress and exacerbating the loss of culture and land. One outcome of World War I, both in Australia and the United States, was the mobilisation of Indigenous peoples in political movements that often named themselves progressive. Aboriginal people and Native Americans called for the return of land and the extension of citizenship rights. Aboriginal political movements in the 1920s in Australia, particularly in New South Wales, reflected both the power and limits of progressive thinking. In other words, what I'm saying is that they take up progressivism as their own cause, at the same time commenting on the limits of white progressivism. Settler colonialism, in the late Patrick Wolfe's influential formulation, rested on, quote, the logic of extermination. But as Lorenzo Veracini has argued in his book Settler Colonialism, A Theoretical Overview, settler colonialism was a distinctive formation, distinctive, that is, from colonialism, in its, quote, triangular system of relationships, a system comprising metropolitan, settler, and Indigenous agencies. Important word there, agencies. Within this triangular set of relationships, colonial settlers, as Veracini writes, were, quote, founders of political orders, and they carried their sovereignty with them. Settlers brought new political and social orders into being. That was their raison d'etre as self-styled pioneers. The whole meaning of pioneer was that they brought new orders into being. They were pioneers of new lands and new social and political orders, and this is the case in settler colonial societies, you know, beyond Australia. The vision of land settlement as the basis of economic independence and political democracy, importantly, political democracy in the New World, exercised a powerful hold on 19th century imaginations, fueling the dispossession of Indigenous peoples and shaping the investment, both emotional and material, in free selection, closer settlement, soldier settlement, and imperial settlement in the Australian colonies, states, and Commonwealth. But by the 20th century, changing world forces were beginning to make a mockery of these ideals and the dreams of so many lured to take up land, simply because I was an 18-year-old hero in the war and upon my return had sufficient faith in human nature to believe the lies told of the Mallee, wrote Harold Nicholls. We can read these words, as I've done, as expressing the anger and sense of betrayal of a returned soldier. And here I'm going to conclude. But we can also read those words as a comment on the larger project of settler colonialism of which he was a part. Settler colonialism offered new opportunities to New World subjects, even as it required the dispossession of Indigenous peoples and the destruction of their culture. It was a project founded in faith, that kind of faith that Harold Nicholls spoke about, even as it also rested on lies, as he noted, on the lies of disavowal and dissimulation perpetrated by the pioneer legend. Harold Nicholls' faith, I'd suggest, and his experience of lies in his own terms were, I want to suggest, part of a much larger Australian history. Thank you.